Drunk.ie Podcast.
Education and information.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Drugs.ie podcast. This episode features two talks, both of which were recorded at the Addicted to Treatment Policy Seminar in the Carlton Hotel Dublin on Wednesday the 13th of February 2008. The first speaker is Dr. Shane Butler, Senior Lecturer with the Department of Social Studies in Trinity College Dublin. The topic of Dr. Butler's talk is Methadone and Treatment, A Time to Reflect. The second speaker is Dr. Paul Quigley, Medical Specialist in Addiction for the HSE Addiction Services in Dublin North Central. The topic of Dr. Quigley's talk is Steps to Effective Addiction Treatment in Disadvantaged Communities. We would like to thank both speakers for granting permission to use the recordings in our podcast. We would also like to extend our thanks to Mary Lawless and the seminar organisers, the Ballymun Local Drugs Task Force.
So I just ask Dr. Shane Butler, Senior Lecturer from the School of Social Work and Social Policy from Trinity College Dublin, to come up and present the next piece. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning. And first, just to thank Ballymun Local Drugs Task Force for asking me to come along, and thank Marie Lawless for coming in to see me and telling me what to say. So, you know, it can't go wrong. 15 minutes. Most people know what academic speakers are like. It would take us 15 minutes as a rule just to clear our throats. So this is going to be difficult, but I'm going to keep going. I started initially when I was preparing this slide by having a much ruder heading, and it was, why is everybody whinging? But then I said, that's very bad. That's offensive. Get rid of that. So instead I went for a more neutral one of the question mark, treatment has improved. Has treatment improved? Since 1996, I suppose lots of people would say that things have improved. If you go back to 1996, the big furore was about the lack of treatment places, in particular the lack of methadone places and the length of waiting lists. But that year was the year that the Rabbit Report, the report with the very long name, the first report to the Ministerial Task Force on Measures to Reduce the Demand for Drugs, you can see why people call it the Rabbit Report, was published. And that was in many ways a major turning point for policy and practice in the drugs area. And following from that, we had the building on experience, the current National Drug Strategy, and as the Minister was saying before he left, we have the process underway to have a second version that will take us through to 2016. In the policy process since 1996, since Rabbit and through the current National Drug Strategy, there has been what I describe as a very substantial bottom-up, the community component in the shape of local and regional drugs task forces. Prior to that, I think that you could say that there was almost civil war, that community groups were constantly at war with the statutory sector, and it was seen that everything was happening in a top-down way. The Rabbit Report also gave the imprimatur for the institutionalisation, I suppose you could call it, of methadone services. And in 1998 we had what's known as the methadone protocol. I won't give you the statutory instrument and the full legal title, but it did put methadone treatment on a statutory footing. And at the moment then we have more than 8,000 people who on a daily basis have been trained on methadone. This is in a system which excludes the people who used to be described as the rogue doctors, the people who are clearly ripping off the system and misbehaving. And while, you know, we certainly haven't got rid of diversion of methadone onto the black market, the system that we have has at least limited that, or has put restrictions on it. The bottom one, you may not be able to read that last one, and it's just that waiting lists are a good deal shorter than they were. So, you know, you could say that treatment has improved, but the problem, if there is a problem, it is that the methadone maintenance, as you've already heard several times this morning, is that it continues to be controversial, it continues to be what I call a bone of contention with many people, particularly people at grassroots or community level, expressing fundamental dislike of the central role that methadone plays in Irish drug treatment policy and practice. So what I'm trying to do in this talk is to take a sociological look at this, to look at the source, as I call it, and the nature of the conflict that surrounds methadone treatment, particularly here in the Dublin drug treatment scene. And although, you know, like most academics are much easier talking about what's wrong and kind of having a bit of fun doing that, I'm going to break the habits of a lifetime and make some suggestions as to how things might be better. Don't tell anyone I've said that or my credibility is shot. It's what I call a methadone war at the moment. The assumptions, the sociological, the academic assumptions underpinning this talk. First, it is that all social problems are socially constructed. So I'm trying to get you to think that I fairly come from a position of relativism. Everything is relative. Social problems are not things that you can discover in some scientific way. I normally try to explain this to students by saying that when I did my social science degree, which is a long time ago, one of the big social problems we had was the unmarried mother. I remember one lecture, as far as I can remember, but you know, and given to fantasy, maybe this didn't happen, but that there was one full lecture in which someone produced a profile of the unmarried mother. And we all took it fairly seriously. This was a dreadful social problem, unmarried mothers. And then a few years later, I discovered all the people who were sitting in the lecture, frankly, were unmarried mothers themselves. And if you gave that lecture like that, you could be probably skinned on the spot. I'm not sure how we discovered that unmarried mothers weren't a problem, but we did. The only way you can understand it is that we had constructed this as a problem and then we deconstructed. And alcohol and drug problems are notoriously contentious. People are always arguing about them. And a lot of the argument, a lot of the conflict is exactly about what is the problem and who owns it. The notion of ownership of social problems. It means who can claim some kind of cultural authority that they are the correct group to take responsibility for it, to be given by society the dominant role in either preventing it or managing it. And I suppose I'll be saying this in relation to conflicts about methadone, that it does represent a tussle for ownership between several groups, but here I'll concentrate on the medical profession and the other group known as vaguely the community. In cultural terms, illicit drugs are commonly represented by sociologists as being demonized. Since we exaggerate, we produce dreadful stereotypes of the awfulness of the drugs. We talk about them as though they are evil spirits. We attribute these kind of diabolical characteristics to them. And there's a great deal of symbolism involved, that the way we talk about drugs, like the ultimate evil. And I'm suggesting that it might help to look at methadone and the controversies surrounding methadone in that context, seeing that this is a row about methadone and it is about different meanings of methadone. Methadone means different things to different people, and I'm looking at two main groups, medical profession and community. Now, what is the medical perspective on methadone? For some doctors, not sure how many, it's difficult to say, opiate dependency is taken by them in a very literal sense, almost a theological sense, as a disease. It's a specific disease for which methadone maintenance is the most effective treatment. The gurus from the 1960s, the New York researchers, Dole and Nyswander, who were referred to indirectly in the film we saw earlier, they certainly came up with this, whether they believe this literally or whether it is a metaphor that, you know, that you can compare opiate dependency to diabetes, and if you have diabetes, you should be damn glad that we have insulin, because that will help you to lead a normal lifestyle. If you have opiate dependency, you should be glad we have methadone and that it is an effective treatment. For other doctors, lots of doctors that I know, they don't buy fully into any disease theory at all. They simply see that this is methadone maintenance is a pragmatic, what I call a humane and pragmatic response to an issue which is complex and is quite ill-defined. This is just something you could do. It seems to work for a lot of people. It's very hard to get absolute definition of what is legitimate medical practice. Is it legitimate for a doctor to prescribe contraceptive pill for a young, fertile woman? Most doctors would say it is. Some doctors would say absolutely not. You know, would Hippocrates prescribe the pill, they say? Would Hippocrates have been running a methadone clinic? We don't know. For all prescribers, methadone is what is called an evidence-based treatment, and this is the kind of mantra that is chanted all the time. People talk about evidence-based practice, evidence-based medicine. This is one that is treatment that is shown by objective research to deliver consistently good health and psychosocial outcomes. Methadone has been researched inside out, upside down. An awful lot of research has been done on methadone. Generally shows it brings stability to people's lives. It improves health outcomes from the point of view, say, reducing the spread of infectious diseases. Not so good for everything, but I mean, it's been good with HIV, to a lesser extent perhaps with hepatitis. Good from the point of view of improving behaviour, reducing criminality. Good in terms of the stability it brings to people's lives, in, you know, if they want to go back to school or where their families or whatever. And controversially, the research generally, which medical people tend to know, it suggests that outcomes are optimised when the doses are high, not when you get into rows with your patients, or whatever you want to call them, about cutting back and reducing the dosage. And outcomes also tend to be best when the prescriber is willing to prescribe for the long haul, indefinite methadone prescribing, saecula saeculorum, till you fall off the twig. And that what emerges from a lot of the research is that if your prescribers who push and confront, the word used in today's conference are about progression, saying it is time to move on, it is time to progress, time to think about coming off your methadone. That kind of approach to working with patients doesn't come out well out of the research. So this is the medical perspective on methadone. Now the community or a lay perspective on methadone. People say this, with the kind of sense that they've been conned. You know, methadone was never meant to be used on an indefinite basis. People say this regularly. And I wonder, who did the meaning? Yeah, but the research has always said something to the contrary, that if people want to stay on methadone, leave them on methadone. But at local level, there's almost a sense that there's a con here, that surely this was meant to be a temporary, transitional phase, not leaving people on it forever. People say that methadone maintenance, it perpetuates addiction, that addiction is undesirable in every way, morally undesirable, practically undesirable, spiritually undesirable, whatever you want. And it is undesirable even when it is state-sanctioned addiction. So people say that's what methadone is. And then at the real grassroots, the people themselves who are on it, there is a great lore about methadone, and people say it's a worse drug than heroin, it's a terrible drug, it's more addictive, from the phrase that I've heard on umpteen occasions, it gets into your bones, you know. So by comparison then, heroin is seen as quite a nice drug, but methadone is a complete killer. And people then say this is a medical model. I love the phrase medical model, because, you know, it's almost an invitation of the audience to hiss and boo. And what it reflects is an oppressive, and I describe it as a mercenary takeover by doctors of a drug problem at the expense of the community. Now, in some way, the management of drugs at local level has been hijacked by the medical profession. Again, this, you know, you can use posh sociological words like hegemony, that they have imposed their own cultural view that this is what addiction is, but the community by and large, when you talk to people, say, no, that's not right. Their view, the community view, is the right one. And the doctors have taken it over, and of course they've done it also because it's lucrative to work with methadone. And final point, lots of people would say doctors actually discourage patients who wish to become abstinent. People who say they want to come off their methadone, that the doctors don't facilitate that, they challenge them. And they don't really facilitate, the medical approach doesn't facilitate any broader rehabilitation. Are we unique in all of this? Are the methadone wars only to be found in Ireland? The answer is they're not. Methadone is controversial globally. Everywhere you go in the world, there is at least ambivalence about methadone. You saw that film from New York, what it was like. Maybe we are unusual, perhaps not unique, but we are certainly unusual in terms of the scale, the level of direct action. And I put that in brackets, that was a phrase used, particularly in the 1990s, by communities against the siting of methadone clinics in Dublin. That was unusual. The aggression that was directed back at the health board at the time when methadone clinics were being first introduced was unusual. In a global context, it's the kind of thing that you would normally only hear when you have people with strong moral views objecting to the siting of, say, an abortion clinic. But the degree of animosity and the degree of anger and the kind of moral outrage that was directed at the health board, who all the poor devils in the health board who were getting very difficult messages saying we need local drug treatment services, and then they tried to open a clinic, but we don't want you to put a methadone clinic here. At the height of it, you probably know that one of the health centres on the south side, where the health board had snuck in the methadone clinic without local consultation, it was torched. Arson. So it's unusual, and there was a lot of really strong localised aggression against methadone. Referring to Scotland, because we're going to have some Scottish speakers in the afternoon, there has been a lot of controversy. The work of Neil McKegney, one of the Scottish sociologists, he's been very pointed over the last few years. He's arguing strongly that when you do comparisons between England and Scotland, the Scottish addicts were maintained on methadone, like the Irish, seem to stay on it for an awful long time, whereas by comparison in England, there seems to be a much greater kind of progression flow through, with lots of people ultimately detoxifying. I'm not sure people know, there's a famous paper by McKegney and his colleagues from about 3 years ago, I suppose, it was now, what do addicts want when they come for treatment? The suggestion is that they don't want harm reduction, they want abstinence. And that again, this is that because we've got into the methadone mindset, that we're conning. My own immediate reaction to that was that certainly all addicts who come for treatment want abstinence, but I'm reminded of the great prayer of St. Augustine, Lord, make me pure, or whatever it was, but not yet. And I suspect that it may be a long-term ambition for people to become drug-free, but it may not be as clear-cut as that paper suggested. One of the local, national features, I suppose, is though that the methadone protocol was introduced very slyly, very surreptitiously. There was no real public debate about it. And the view, and I've written about this in a few places, the view of authorities was that if you did have a big public debate about methadone, I don't think you would ever have had the methadone protocol. So they introduced it as a statutory instrument, which was perfectly legal, but it certainly meant that we didn't have a public debate. And in a way, what we are now experiencing 10, 12 years on is a sort of backlash, or because people are beginning to kind of get their heads around this. And you could say maybe we should have had the debate back then. And on the other hand, I am fairly sympathetic to the small group of people who introduced this, and particularly to a few of the sort of faceless bureaucrats, some very, very clever civil servants who I think acted, in good faith and did what they thought was needed at the time. But one way or another, we are stuck with this now that we haven't had a debate, and perhaps we're just beginning to embark on it. Which of the two sides is right? Well, if you expect anyone from a social science background to answer that question, you'll be waiting. These are two perspectives. This is a clash of two cultures. In the best tradition of ivory tower, sort of sitting on the fence, you can poke holes at both, and I'll slag off the two just very briefly. The scientific underpinning of methadone isn't at all as strong as is normally suggested. You can look at an awful lot of the research. You can go into great detail about randomized controlled trials. It's not that rigorous, but it's okay. But I've picked out one: quality of life. You tend not to get a much focus on quality of life. In the general area of psychiatry, if you look at some of the drugs that are used, whether it's for treatment of depressive disorders or for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, you can have a narrow focus on whether in fact it seems to get rid of the symptoms, but by and large there is much greater awareness that you need to focus on what quality of life the patient has, not just are they symptom free or are their symptoms getting a little bit better. In the area of methadone, there hasn't been much focus on quality of life, and I think that most people at grassroots level, what they're picking up is that even though people on methadone seem to use much less street heroin, they use an awful lot of other things, they use a lot of benzos, has been talked about, and for many of them they seem to be trapped, they haven't moved on, the quality of their life generally from the point of view of their family life, their education, their occupational training or getting into the workforce, things like that, their ordinary needs for a place to live, a lot of that hasn't really been improved. That's one area we could say the research is wanting. And of course people know, If it's all that scientific, why don't all the doctors accept it? Most people know that there are lots of doctors who will have nothing to do with methadone. I quote from the public domain, Dr. John O'Connor, who was the clinical director in Trinity Court, had long expressed reservations. And if you look at the reports that led to the methadone protocol, the first of the reports, they were never published. They were all very sort of quiet. But in an appendix to one of those written by Dr. O'Connor, he says, you know, we should never consider methadone a treatment. It's just an adjunct to treatment. You go down the West, and there are people from the West here today. Dr. Greg Kelly got great publicity. He's a GP in Castlereagh, which is where there's a prison. He was also, I think, chairman of the Western Health Board before the health boards were abolished. And one of those doctors who've been very public about saying that methadone is unacceptable. So there are doctors who don't go along with the science at all. On the other hand, if we look at the community sector and the sort of nice, soft, talking therapy people, the medical model, I say, has no oppression or no monopoly on oppression. There has been an awful lot of really, really dodgy practice in the counselling and psychotherapy area with addicts. Over the years, being an addict meant that counsellors and psychotherapists could throw away the rule book and be as viciously aggressive with you as they wanted to be. We had this history of confrontation. Addicts need to be confronted. Being an addiction counsellor was almost like, you know, James Bond, licensed to kill. And we have a long history of really aggressive stuff, people being treated in allegedly therapeutic settings in a way that would be intolerable within a prison. And of course, finally, the community is not necessarily as benign as is normally suggested. Drug users are stigmatized, socially excluded group in many areas. The community can be very rough. People are excluded from communities. Social exclusion, which is a great catchphrase nowadays, often occurs at local level. So the community isn't all benign. We know that particularly from the area of mental health, where the business are trying to locate residential facilities for people who are being deinstitutionalized. There's a long history of people saying, not in my backyard. Making some suggestions before I finish, at local drugs task force level, I'm suggesting that it might be possible to develop good practice guidelines for methadone maintenance, and these should be negotiated between the doctors, the prescribers, and the community. I think the community should recognize that doctors have real professional difficulties in having a third party interfere in their practice. It's not part of the profession. You have a patient, you work with your patient. The idea that some crowd of people that you regard as moralists, at times they are, someone who doesn't seem to have any clear electoral mandate, you don't know how democratically representative they are, interferes with your work with the patient. It's not something doctors can take easily. So we need to recognize for doctors who are operating in good faith, this is a difficulty. Doctors themselves should recognize that the community has a legitimate role to play in what is, to a very large extent, a localized problem. So that old-fashioned medical model, me and my patient, isn't an entire answer to the thing either. And I'm suggesting that maybe a case review system should be established involving doctors and people that are called case managers, not counsellors, but case managers from the local drugs task forces. The basic principles involved, I made this up on the back of an envelope, but it's probably as good as anything anyone else would make up. When patients have been on methadone for 2 years and thereafter, on an annual basis, there should be a review of their status to see, first of all, whether they wish to remain on their current dose, whether they want to increase the dose or decrease it, or whether they want to consider detoxification and becoming abstinent. Hope that's clear enough. It should be made clear to patients, and maybe I should continue with the inverted commas around it, that the choice is theirs and only theirs. They cannot be detoxified against their wishes. This is a review which is genuinely open. You are not putting pressure, you are not coercing anyone into becoming drug-free or becoming abstinent. And for patients who opt to detoxify, they should be reassured that if this proves impracticable, then there are mechanisms in place to take them back immediately onto a methadone program. Because one of the fears people have is that if you start to come off or if you become drug-free, you'll never get back in again. It's like losing your place in a very elite club. You go to the end of the queue and God knows when you come back. So that is not a great incentive for people who think, even vaguely think, about becoming drug-free. Finally, However difficult it may be to implement the interagency model of rehabilitation, the one that Pat Carey referred to from last year's rehabilitation report, this should be tackled immediately with a review to making improvements in the overall quality of life of people who are, as I described, the multiply deprived drug users. Our drug users don't simply have an addiction to opiates or anything else. You know, they have, and I wouldn't disagree with anything that Tony Humphrey said. But they are, from a point of view of social deprivation, they are people with lots of problems. And if we're going to improve their lot in life, we have to do more than prescribe a substitute drug for them. We have to work on all those other things. Despite its complexity, I think that last year's rehabilitation report was good, and I think that we should give it a fair shot. And absolutely, finally, anybody opting for a detoxification and a drug-free life should be given well-planned, ongoing education on what it means to lose your opiate tolerance and on the risks attached to resuming street drug use. Because there is such a high risk of fatal overdose when people have become drug-free, have what they call a slip, go back onto street heroin, and assume that they can take the same dose as they were able to cope with a year ago when they were on methadone. And for doctors, I think this is one of the real fears they have, that it may not be ideal to have a patient on methadone, but it's always good to have a patient who's alive at least. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shane Butler, and it's great to have something so succinct. I know a lot of that was tongue-in-cheek, but I'm absolutely certain there was so much research and experience behind all of that. Thank you very much. And also set the platform now to hear perspectives from both, as Shane said, the medical and the community approaches. So I'll ask Dr. Paul Quigley from the HSE to give his perspective. Thank you very much.
Morning, folks. Thanks very much. Thank you, Shane and Tony. Thoroughly appreciated those views, and I agree with really everything I've heard. I'm going to say a thing or two about my own experience and the experience of my colleagues in the HSE Addiction Services, which is not a very old part of healthcare in Ireland. It's no more than 15 years, and it's been 15 rocky years, but I think good ones in the end of the day. So we've had to learn how to do it, and along the way how to stop doing certain things that were making things worse. So I'll just go through this to whatever degree is possible within the slot that I'm there. Okay, I mean, everybody knows the story of the background, but it's fair to say that we didn't know anything about opiates in Ireland in any serious way until the 1980s. Although we were well used to alcoholism and all that goes with that, so we certainly had no reason to say we knew nothing but addiction. We knew it inside and out. We were able to manage to convince ourselves that this was something completely different. It had very disturbing consequences, of course, thieving and stealing and all of those things, very damaging in communities, all the various multiple harms. And we had the public denial for a very long period, during which, personally, I wasn't in Dublin and lived through that, but I'm sure many of you have done. It can't have been very nice. And nothing happened usefully by way of treatment for many long years, and that was what was made a phrase earlier from Tony, the violence of silence. And I think that's a fact. That was a very violent, silent abuse that happened in that era, and many people died who should never have died, and are crippled today who should never have been crippled. So today things have moved on. My involvement is exactly 10 years this month. And I started the Northside Drug Services with the following treatment model, which was inherited from the psychiatrists in Trinity Court. And I suppose the message was, go out there to the communities and do this. And it can be boiled down, sure. It can be, I suppose, summarized very simply in that we were to develop a controlling relationship with the addicts. Of course, also to deliver various medical treatments which might be required for their health, but a controlling relationship through methadone. And it was based on a contract system which we inherited, and it had clear sanctions for so-called dirty urines, which included transfer off the program to low-dose methadone after a period of time, and this is entirely involuntary. And of course, it was not well received by the clients. I would say that was based on a very major fear in the medical profession of dealing with this client group at all. We were basically afraid of them. Also, we had a major fear that other doctors would take a dim view, sanction us, or in other words, consider us poor practitioners in some way if we prescribe methadone. So that message, certainly if we prescribed it in any, if you like, liberal fashion or whatever we can, this is a decent fashion. In other words, if we were to prescribe in ways that are considered standard elsewhere in the world, we would have been regarded as doing something very dodgy. So it was a question of legitimacy, and that of course resulted, as Shane has pointed out in his book about drug and alcohol policy, that happened because there was no preparation of healthcare staff for the move from abstinence-oriented treatment to harm reduction in the 1990s. So it was basically fought out on the ground and in a rather rough way. And the rough way was that there were plenty of incidents in which people were threatened and plenty of suicides and self-harming and all that stuff like that. But that was all supposed to be their fault. Of course, it was mostly ours. So the local client group that we met when I went out to Ballymun first was, I would class them as professional operators in this area. They were serious, but those are the characteristics, I think, as chronic a group of injectors as you'll ever come across anywhere in the world. And I suppose hopelessness was the main thing that you see when you see that sort of a state of affairs. And many of them had been without proper treatment for 15 years and more. And they were, needless to say, less than pleased about all of that. They might make their views known, mostly without telling you, mostly just exuding certain types of unpleasant stuff, which are all very understandable. And their demands were in that order, in my personal experience. The first demand the clients had, assuming that they got what they regarded as a fair dose of methadone, that was the first struggle to get to that point. The first demand, and still the main demand I hear in my work, is for takeaways. And the brilliant thing about a takeaway is it gives the choice back to the patient. In other words, you can drink your methadone, or you can do something else with it. Whereas if you have to drink it in a tank, of course, you've got to do what the doctor wants you to do, and that has its disadvantages to give them the choice. The next thing, of course, is tablets, and practically a very great proportion of people will tell you that they are addicted to sleeping tablets, and many indeed are. So that was also remains a very strong client demand, and it's met to various degrees by practitioners, either in clinics or outside clinics. Certainly it's fair to say that all our work in Dublin around benzodiazepines has shown that the supplies are undiminished, and there are no prospects of reducing that problem. Stuff like insurers, nutrition supplements, they have, I think, a mythical value among the addict population, and they're certainly sought after. Painkillers for tooth problems, very common. It's a very common request because a lot of people have bad teeth. Very understandable. Forms and grants, anything that can bring you cash, any sort of a form that you can fill in that can bring cash is naturally attractive to people who are usually in debt. Court reports always require if people are in trouble with the law, especially the men. And down at the bottom, I'm not saying at all that it is in any sense the bottom thing, but it's part and parcel, this has to make some sort of list, that people have seek crisis counselling, which is quite a different thing from attending in any kind of scheduled way to deal with your addiction. So in my experience, the detox requests that I've had have been generally driven by family pressure. They have been part of an effort on the client's part sometimes to hold on to takeaways or being threatened. So as long as you leave me on my takeaways, I'll take a smaller dose, but don't stop my takeaways. Very common argument. People get tired attending on dailies. This is a drag. And so you get more detox requests if people are more on people on dailies. Or they need to get away from the neighborhood for various reasons, some of which are perfectly legitimate. So this is the service pressure that the clients have put on the practitioners. I think this is exactly how it hits you, and it's not always very easy to deal with, and certainly there's always a sense when you're a prescriber that if you meet the client's requests that you're likely to be looked on in the wrong way by your colleagues, because everything you do sets a standard for others, or maybe sets a standard for you, and I can assure you, where sleepers and relaxers are concerned, there's a total absence of consensus in this city among people who do methadone as to whether you should or you shouldn't do it. Just to give you a little look at the urine sampling, I don't think anyone will be surprised by this. It just illustrates the multi-substance problem and the high prevalence of benzodiazepines there you see in the blue. minding your P's. I think your examples do tell you, the P tells you quite a lot about what people are actually doing, which is the benefit of supervised sampling. At least you can have a real discussion with the patient, and it gives some handle on takeaways. But it doesn't say something there, which is the big X in it all, of course, is who's on the drink. Because the best way to provide brilliant samples in the clinic is to be drinking a bottle of vodka a day, and then you can, well, perhaps that might give you something in the arms, but certainly drinking is the best way to clean up your samples, and sadly in this town there are too many people, it might be your own takeaway medication, who are a major drink problem, but they give great samples, spotless samples in the clinic, and that's our fault for being completely obsessed with heroin and failing to recognise alcoholism. And the reality of the statistics is that if you have a serious drinking problem, in addition to your opiate addiction, on methadone, you will be 20 times more likely to die. And generally speaking, those are the deaths that we see. Plus suicide and all those things are commoner in drugs. So the hard cases, we know them well, and we meet many of them. And anyone who's working with addicts knows the story, and it's been said already, you know, Lord save me, I forget the quote, make me pure, but not yet. So we are preparing to go for abstinence tomorrow. I guess don't today. And that will give me the strength for it. And oftentimes that's a circle and goes on and on and on. I'm not stoned on hash, but I'm stoned on, as a client very honestly said to me, I'm very fond of, he said to me when I was having an issue with him about tablets and hash, he said, "Doctor, I'll be honest with you," he said, "you've a lot of patients. Do you know anyone that just takes methadone?" And it was a perfectly honest comment, because everybody, by and large, not everybody, but a large number of people top up with something. And that just reflects the fact that people are trying to hold on to their intoxication, the stone, the goof, while fitting into the program in some way. And there's often waiting for rescue and working the system while you're there. So we have to accept that people, as Tony said, are creative. And if they're in a treatment system, they'll use that system to get what they want out of it. And get the other ones getting stoned sometimes, or even a lot of times, and that's what they do. We can't legislate for people's motivation. But of course, hard cases like that live in hard places. And I think that's the point made there by Shane very correctly, that the places where we work and the places where our clinics are located are where all these difficulties are there. And they're not small difficulties. They're surrounding all of our patients that they're living with these things, whether it's their own children having difficulties in conduct, or whether they're themselves having those difficulties, or their neighbours. It's stressful. It's very easy to depend on sedatives if someone's battering at your door or smashing your windows or damaging your car or interfering with your kids. You know, this is not easy to live in, and all of those things are, you know, no medication will remove them, but it would be, I think, and I think the minister said it earlier, and he does recognize, I believe, that this stuff can't be prescribed away. The only thing I would say, the Russians have an expression for all this. They say the situation is hopeless but not serious. And I think that's probably a healthy point of view in when you work in these environments. And lots of people say to us, it's very common, I'm sure my colleagues who are here, some very good colleagues in our service, would hear this from time to time very regularly. I need to get out of here, doctor. I need to get out of here, nurse, counsellor, because I just can't get myself sorted in this place. And that's the reason why, because where you're the heroin addict, the three people around you are drinking too heavily, but you're the junkie. But they're official okay addicts in the drug we all love and advertise. And it's easy to slip back into tablets when people around you are taking them. When your family takes them, why would you not? I mean, as a man said to me about cannabis, another patient, he said, "Doctor, the cannabis is the only thing I have," to which I replied, "in addition to the methadone and the sleepers." And that's a fact, but he's incorporated the sleepers and the methadone into kind of just his daily diet. So when he wants to have a space where he gets stoned, you'd like to join it. And that's a ritual. And the cocaine and alcohol, all these things are well known, so I won't dally on them, except to say there's a lot more of them about in the places where the clinics are, and a lot of it is very heavy and rough. So the situation in 2008, we all know the statistics that were quoted. The reality of this, it's a point, a professional point in passing, and speaking about the medical profession, is there is no way in which general practitioners in Ireland as a group are going to take on either most of the methadone cases in the country or most of the difficult cases. And the reality is that the very difficult, complex, aggressive, awkward cases are in the HSE clinics or in Trinity Court, and the biggest volume will be there and will be there for the long term. Personally, I don't anticipate the ordinary general practitioners taking on much more of the load, which is about a third. And indeed many of those are themselves involved in the addiction service in some way. So in the Ballymun area, just thought I'd mention, 500 in treatment with 300 at Donvan House. It's a substantial clinic. I've worked in it for 10 years. And it works because I think it's pragmatic, as a point was made earlier. We don't have any great beliefs about addiction being a biological process. I think the belief is more how we can help people to function. And I think we've shown that we can do that. And those are the preventable harms. Nothing new there. Those I think if you can prevent any of those sorts of phenomena, you're doing a good job in the day. And I think if we did nothing else in our work except reduce the levels of those things in some substantial or serious way, that our addiction service would be very valuable. I hope we do it. And I'm sure we're the only people doing that. Many other agencies and voluntary organisations contributing to the work, trying to somehow bring down the horror show. So we've looked at how not to do methadone maintenance at the start, how to do it a bit better, going for the long term, and these are the overall accepted principles of quality in methadone maintenance treatment. It is never a question of doctors changing to a better view because it's scientific. I think probably those who are dug into a very ideological perspective would hold on to it. But most people are middle of the road, and if they see something is working, then they'll do it. And that's what's happened in our service, is that doctors who were probably quite suspicious about methadone, they worked in the service, if they stayed long enough, to see the good effect that it has on people, and so that there's no longer an issue, really, at any level, about the need to continue doing it. That's just not an issue at all. Giving methadone maintenance long term, that's what we do, and it's simply not debated at this stage. Adequate dosing, the same. I mean, the idea that you just jump somebody down to 20 or 30 milligrams because they were annoying you with their urine samples, that would not be tolerated, because other staff wouldn't have it, patients wouldn't have it, and relatives wouldn't have it, generally speaking. Supervised ingestion, I think, is an important one, because if you don't have an arrangement where you can see that somebody is taking the medication, then the easiest and simplest thing to do is to assume that they're sharing it with somebody else. And it's estimated in the UK that for every bottle of methadone goes out, three people drink it. And that's understandable, because people are swapping drugs with each other, they're swapping money, they're swapping sexual services, they're all kinds of deaths. And it's also a sharing thing, drug taking. So if somebody drinks the dose at Hatch or the chemist's, one thing could be sure of is that they got the dose. And the supervised ingestion, of course, the psychological support services and psychosocial, they're critical, but they're not as, if you like, they don't lend themselves to medical organisations. Those are something, just to give you some clue of the volume of work that gets done in a reasonable sized treatment centre. Those are very rough figures, but they might equally apply to City Clinic or to Ashling and Valley Fairness, Donvan House. Any of the big clinics, what I call around 300 mark, the biggest of all would be Trinity Court, which is about 500. So 60,000 supervised methadone doses. Not all those people taking those doses are reasonable and sensible. Some of them are awkward enough about it and trying to stick it in their jumper. So other supervised medication, total dispensing is 150,000 a year. I mean, there are places you can hide in a methadone service, but one of them is not in the pharmacy. Because in the pharmacy, you're caught in two ways. You've got the client standing in front of you who know exactly what they're looking for. And if they don't get it, they're complaining instantly. And you have your regulatory obligations to keep a full and accurate record of everything you do, which is not small, and pharmacists are heavily burdened with regulation. So it is the engine room of the clinic. And I want to contribute to the work of the pharmacists here, because they have to work at that pace every day. So and work in a safe way. You're sampling 15,000. I mean, by UK standards, we do a lot of it here. That's all supervised, and it's a lot of work. And again, I have to say that's a lot of effort. Plus, some of the people are paranoid. Some of them are uncooperative. And it's not easy to. You can be injured doing that work if you're dealing with someone who's in a bad frame of mind, and it happens. Ditto, psychiatric hospital in that regard. So medical, nursing, counselling sessions, they're all very vague numbers, but they give you some idea of the kind of volume. And when I say sessions, medical, I mean a half day's work rather than a single person coming in. It tends to be a different kind of work than counselling. So those are volumes. So we have a substantial service now with many people, and we have a very substantial budget and a lot of staff. But it is at this stage, I think, a very well-established mainstream part of the HSE that unparalleled with the mental health services. It's not going to go away. So within the HSE, as I would believe it anyway, I don't think there's any issue that this is going to continue. I'm sorry? Okay, I'm going to just zip through Gringa to you. That's fine. Zip through the tail end of this then. Those are the service quality measures that I think we have tried to deliver at Donville and other places where I'm involved. Obviously, good access is critical, because if people are waiting for treatment, that's not access. And so we've, in the clinics I'm involved in, certainly around the north side, there has been no waiting list for many years, other than a week or two, which is significant in most cases. Open communication is important, and that's where the task forces are vital. That I think it's important that local drugs task forces are fully informed about what goes on in clinics, that service is congruent. That is to say, we do hear the story of the person, and we're able to spend enough time. And that means, in many ways, not hassling people. You know, people will tell you their story if you don't be giving them grief. And that, so we have to learn how to do that, how to stick quiet and just provide the service and not be telling clients how to think. And we've depended on our friends in the Youth Action Project, who were around for a very long time before HSE services, to tell us what is good and what is bad about the whole approach. And in our own organisation, internally, we have to develop better and we are developing team processes where people can be open about what they're doing with each other and trying not getting each other's hair and all those good things. So that can create, I think, this sense of belonging that Tony is talking about. And I think it is one of the very good things about a clinic service, that you can have somewhere that every day you come into, or that you don't get abused, that you get tolerated, that you're said hello to, that you can, if you want, talk at more length about yourself or maybe get a bit of help with practical things, and you can belong to that. And if other people belong to you, like your family or friends, want to somehow come into that process, that we should be open to it. I hope that's where we're going with it all. It has to be said that it's contrary entirely to the traditional psychiatric model, which is about excluding everybody except the patient. I don't think that works at all in this field. And I think would have gone much further forward if we had any encouragement from the psychiatric end, but we haven't. So we will do it ourselves. That's our outcomes from 2007. Interesting to see. I mean, 5% of the patients, that's rough again, attempted a detox. So not very many more people come off than die. Not many. And the 12% is really people just circulating around to prison or other clinics. And most people stay on. I mean, in rural terms, keeping 80% of people on, that's good retention. I think it's the way we're doing it is right. There's a lot that could be said, which I won't, but just 30 seconds literally, about why addicts are as they are. If you work and study the problem, there are a great deal of things that are common. There are psychological states, there are social states, there are familial problems that clearly are related. There are major problems in the larger community. And of course, internally in the HSE, we have many, many organizational problems which we have to face. And we have to face difficult questions of how to work together and how to talk about issues that we normally avoid. And all of that, we hope to work, continue with our partners in the voluntary sector and in the academic sector, with everyone we could go forward. Thank you very much.
Drugs.ie Podcast.
Education and information.